Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome to another Urbanite interview here on The Mark Steiner Show. We're about to talk with Anish Chopra, who is the United States Chief Technology Officer and Associate Director for Technology at the White House, otherwise known as the Innovations Czar for President Barack Obama.
I don't use that term.
that's kind of an – nobody likes those terms anymore, do they?
No.
We don't use that anymore. But so whether it is the chief technology officer or as the press would want to call you, the Innovations Czar, what does that mean? Talk a bit about what this new position really means for the White House and for America.
Well, thank you for the opportunity. I serve essentially two roles, one role that's been in existence for nearly 30 years, and that is to serve as the Associate Director for Technology in the White House Office of Science and Technology Policy. In a nutshell, that traditional role had been the centerpiece for interagency cooperation and collaboration on technology matters writ large. That is, how are we organized on communications issues? What are we going to do to promote research and development activities focused on technology? And broadly speaking, how might we spur more technological innovation? And that role has been around for quite some time and has had, in varying administrations, higher or lower priority. What President Obama had done in the campaign and early in the administration was to acknowledge that which we all know to be true today. That is, you cannot have a conversation about the broader issues without understanding the role that technology and innovation might have within them, whether it be changing our healthcare system, modernizing our educational system, thinking about ways to improve our approach to energy independence. These issues all presume a certain amount of opportunity for technology and innovation to deliver game-changing benefits. And it is in that context where the President asked that we have a chief technology officer who has a voice at the table, who can participate in conversations on these broader sets of topics, and can infuse those conversations with what the potential is for technology and innovation. It is an expanded role than what we'd traditionally seen, which is narrowly focused on just technology policy itself. And so to do that, the President has asked that I serve as an assistant to the President in this chief technology officer role. And what that means is there are roughly 25 assistants to the President. We gather every morning in the West Wing. It ranges from the President's economic team to the environmental team to the healthcare team. And we ensure that there is thoughtful coordination and collaboration across a range of issues. And it is in that regard this has been a relatively new role, and I think hopefully a positive one, because it acknowledges that we can do so much more with less if we thoughtfully embrace technology and innovation.
So in your role here that you just described, how much interaction do you have in around issues like, let's say, in energy like the smart grid, or in healthcare technology, or in something as sensitive as cybersecurity, given the things that intelligence agencies have said recently, which we'll talk about? But how much effect and input do you really have in those fields and what you do?
Oh, I'd say a reasonably high degree. I would describe my interventions in three parts. First, my job is to make sure that the President gets the best advice he can to think through the issues and options before him whenever any of those issues come to the table. So to some degree, I am providing an independent set of eyes and ears to the President on those topics that have homes within the various agencies. Second, many of these issues require interagency cooperation and collaboration. And in that context, I'm often leading White House interagency working groups. One of the policy tools we have at our disposal is in the National Science and Technology Council, a legal structure that's been in place since the early 90s that formalizes how cabinet members, agencies in particular, interface with the White House on these themes of science and technology cooperation. And then third, I do a great deal of public-private collaboration. So how do we interface with the private sector to help set forth the right policies that we have? So I'll be very specific. Healthcare IT is one that we believe to be foundational to the overall discussion of health reform. And as you may or may not recall, the stimulus package called on HHS to make available some estimate north of $20 billion in incentive payments to physicians who are willing to adopt certain technologies that are capable of delivering healthcare reform outcomes. We call that a term, meaningful use.
Mm-hmm.
The foundation of that investment is whether or not there are technology standards that would allow physicians to communicate with one another, with their patients, with hospitals, and with their broader healthcare system. Those technical standards are going to be developed in a rule that we'll be publishing later this month. And it was my responsibility for chairing the implementation work around this rule so that we are designing something that actually can be implemented within a short period of time and that achieves our policy objectives. And to do that, we opened up the dialogue to public and private resources. We engaged our federal agencies in the process, and it was my honor and privilege to help weigh in on how we set those technical standards to ensure the kind of game-changing policy goals that we need out of this particular investment.
Well, let's stick for just a minute with health IT. I mean, you know a great deal about that. You've been in that field for a long time. That's one of the places you came out of, right? Am I correct about that?
Yes, sir.
So when you look at this technology that you want physicians to buy into to connect the information they have on patients is on one level, but on another level, it seems you've got a massive amount of information and a technology that has to be developed if, in fact, there's going to be a nationwide sharing, as they attempt to do in Canada and Britain, of health information about our patients, A.
Yes.
And B, that lends itself to a larger discussion about empowering patients, but also the problems of the privacy.
Yes. So let me tackle this in several parts. The first is define the problem you're trying to solve and then build the technical specs to solve it and it alone. One of the challenges is that if we overly engineer the technology without understanding the health reform objectives that we're trying to achieve, we run the risk where more information might be exposed than people would otherwise want, and that leads to the concerns on privacy and security. So all of these issues you've described go hand in hand, but it starts with a very basic premise. What are the health reform objectives we are trying to achieve? We basically want physicians and patients to have access to the right information about the right interventions to the various conditions they have at the right time so that they can get high-quality health care. Once you set the parameters right, then you sit and design the engineering around how do I communicate the right information, how many physicians have to be around the table to share information in order to get to that right answer, how much information should be available to the patient and at what time in this process. When you start to get into those scenarios, you then very carefully and artfully design privacy principles that can achieve those outcomes goals. And that is exactly the heart of the debate we've been having in the health IT standards process. The public hearings, the testimony, all of that has been to say we acknowledge that if health information moves from paper to digital, it becomes a greater risk that as a digital asset, it can be prone to a cyber attack,
mm-hmm.
that there are technical answers on how one could protect data, that is, if it's in a database, how do you protect it, which is separate in part from I would like the authority to send this information to Dr. X. And in that process of sharing information with Dr. X, how can I do so in a safe, secure way? The good news is as you break these different ideas apart, there are existing technical standards for security and privacy that one can adopt without having to reinvent the wheel to make sure that a patient's very sensitive medical information can be protected as we progress from a paper environment to a digital environment. And as long as we do so in a thoughtful way and we have a process to hear concerns and we weigh those issues forward as we do under our health IT standards development process, then I believe we're going to get to the right mix of data liquidity, patient privacy, and achieving the healthcare goals we need.
When you look at the two things here, in terms of this IT, the health IT, and we'll kind of move into a different area after this, is that if you look at all the problems, the machinations going on now with Google and other parts of the information industry, the digital industry right now and the power of Google or the power of Microsoft in competition with the power of Google and all the rest. And you talk about it developing a nationwide system that contains hundreds of millions of Americans' medical information within it. Who controls that? I mean, who pays for that?
Yeah, let's be very clear. What you're describing is a noun, that there is a thing, and
yes.
In that thing are all of my personal medical information.
Exactly. It is a noun, right.
That's right. Actually, I disagree with the premise that there has to be a thing.
Uh-huh.
And in fact, what we really focus on is the verb. That is, I have certain conditions, and I'd like to share those conditions with a doctor, with my insurance company, with whomever. So the goal of the Nationwide Health Information Network, and essentially the premise behind how we will move this system forward, is that we already have, all across this country, hundreds and hundreds of hospitals, in fact, we have thousands of hospitals, and hundreds of thousands of physicians, each of whom have authority over a database that they already have today. And the question is, how do we set standards so that when information moves from my physician office to hospital A or to physician office B or to patient C, that the act of moving that information is governed by a set of security and privacy protecting standards? There is no probability, I would suggest, that a national single noun database will be created, funded by God knows who and where,
mm-hmm.
that will store all of this. That would violate a great deal of what we've been trying to achieve in this objective. So I'm so thankful you asked that question, because for those of you listening to this show, the goal of the health information technology platform is just focused on those narrow circumstances when information should move from point A to point B, and that when information is within a hospital or a physician's office, that it's being properly utilized to avoid errors, so that a reminder is given to the doctor that if they order a particular drug, oops, that particular drug has an adverse reaction to something that's already in the patient's allergy system that may not have been top of mind to the physician when they were ordering it. So we improve the quality of care within an organization by creating more robust capabilities within health information technology systems, and that we have a private and secure mechanism for the exchange of that information at the border's edge, only in those circumstances when you want to send your records to someone else, and you've authorized them and you've got a set of privacy controls around how and in what manner that information should move.
Now, you, a little digression here, because you really, what I've read about you is that you really are keyed in on this conversation about technology and the debate between nouns and verbs.
Yes, sir.
This is huge with you, isn't it?
It is, because I think that so much of us get excited on a personal level because of the new cell phone or the new computer that's got a particular design. We're obsessed in the media around the cool nouns.
Right.
And from a policy standpoint, a great deal of what we're trying to achieve are a set of verbs that can be better empowered through the use of technology. You want to educate a child? Well, we do so today with a classroom that looks the same as it might have looked maybe 100 years ago. Teacher in front of a group of students going through materials. Well, in a modernized environment, what does a purely digital experience look like from a learning standpoint? I'm not saying that should be the answer for all of our schools, but we should have a discussion about that. The verb, how do I educate a child? And what are the capabilities that now our technology sector can produce that can help us learn as we educate the child? Could you imagine a platform that understands how a child learns, and as they understand the child's learning ability, actually changes the software and how it teaches a concept so it better matches the way a child learns? This kind of cognitive learning, these are not so futuristic concepts. There's actually capability today to help do some of this work, and my job is to find a thoughtful way to introduce that into our policy framework.
Now, you talked about education, so let me move over here to education for a minute. That we spend a lot of time in local school systems and around this country, and in talking about education and in the speeches of presidential candidates and senators and congressmen and the rest about innovation in education and technology in education. But we, again, it's a noun verb thing on one level.
Yes.
Is it? But the proof is really where the rubber meets the road, so to speak, that we talk about this, but the idea of really introducing technology and that kind of technology on a massive scale in our public education system takes a huge investment. I mean, it takes money, and if we want to turn this country around on a massive level in terms of how our students interact with technology and how we use technology for the future of our children.
So I would answer your question in this way. I would say, first and foremost, the timing couldn't have been any better because we are literally, I wouldn't say days away because I can never predict how these things unfold, but let's assume in the near future we'll be publishing the application guidelines for the I3 fund, the Invest in Innovation Fund, out of the stimulus package through the Department of Education. And I would direct your listeners to www.ed.gov, and you can find information about the Invest in Innovation Fund. $650 million precisely to go after the question that you've outlined. Thankfully, Secretary Arne Duncan happens to really understand the relationship between innovation and education. And back in August, he delivered a remarkable speech outlining the need for game-changing ideas to address our educational system. And by the way, the text of that speech is also available on ed.gov. It was a great set of remarks. I think it was mid-August. There are several things. Obviously, you mentioned resources. This $650 million will help us from early-stage ideas, sort of seed capital, really creative ideas that don't often get the chance to see the light of day. Those will be candidates for this investment fund. Ideas that have been proven in one school but need to have a little bit more resource to prove the value in maybe a region. There'll be hopefully a set of grants that would go towards demonstrating the success more than just the anecdote, but to kind of prove it out a little bit further. And then for those ideas that actually have been proven successful in a region but now need a platform for national rollout, we'll have resource grants available to pursue those activities. So for the first time, we're going to have this incredible asset born out of the stimulus package that will help us to change the way we think of education in the 21st century, and to at least prototype and scale some of these really early ideas. What's the measure of success? Obviously, we have very strong outcomes goals, and none could be more important than the president's goal that the United States return by the year 2020 to the nation with the highest proportion of college graduates of any else on earth. And so clearly what we have to do is find a way using technology and innovation to reduce the number of dropouts, to increase the number of those who pursue GEDs and pursue ultimately community college and then four-year schooling. All of that will be the measure of success as we look to these new interventions. And I have had tremendous experience and honor in serving in Governor Kaine's cabinet in Virginia, where we tried to prototype some small new ideas to go after some of this increase in the graduation rate through technology innovation. Happy to chat about that.
Yeah, you did. I mean, when you were in Virginia, a couple things happened. You created that online physics textbook in a year instead of 5 years, and you did things like opening classrooms up to technology and letting kids do learning from home and distance learning.
Yes, sir.
Right?
Yes, and I would say probably the one that I'm most proud of was the one that had the least amount of, quote, technology in it, and that was an initiative we called Plugged In. And the plug in the Plugged In stood for GED, so capital GED. The bold proposition of that pilot project was that we could take a high school dropout and in 6 months put them on path to get a technology job. And that idea was conceived in July of 2008. We funded a prototype, the first class of 20 students. We funded it in August, enrolled those students in January, and the classes basically went from February 1 through July and graduated the first batch of students at the end of July. Several of them have now technology jobs. Many others have pursued, they've completed the GED, and now they're on to community college to continue their training. I am very proud of the results from the Plugged In initiative, and it had a very basic goal. How can we modernize the curriculum, simplify the GED, include IT curriculum, we pulled Microsoft IT Academy content, and build a contextualized program so that you actually are developing something at the end which you could show people, hey, I built a software program, or hey, I built this game using what I've learned in school. And to take all of that and do it in 6 months, it was heart-wrenching to hear the stories of the students who enrolled about the difficulty they went through in life and why they dropped out. And then at the same time, extremely inspiring to see them at graduation talk about how this has changed their outlook in life and how they're focused on what they can do to be successful. And gosh, I hope programs like that can scale.
Well, you just took the word out of my mouth. How do you get those things to scale? Because, I mean, one of the things that always seems to happen is these programs happen and they affect a few kids, but they don't reach the massive scale needed to affect the millions of children in America who have dropped out or not in school, who could be a real wealth for America, but are not. So how do you translate that?
Well, that's exactly why President Obama, through the Office of Management and Budget, has set guidance that we now want to move to a world of research and evaluation on some key initiatives. Because it would be one thing for me to anecdotally celebrate Virginia's experience with Plugged In and all of a sudden say, gosh, this should be a national program. That would probably be an inappropriate thing to do. What you'd want to do is to take these results, engage an independent research and evaluation component, study what works, learn what didn't, scale up to the next level, which is to try this in a half a dozen more locations, see the results, and if they're proven to be successful, then consider how you would mature this into the ecosystem. But to simply move from an anecdote to national rollout would probably be an inappropriate and likely lead to failure, which is why the I3 Fund is such an important framework here, because it starts with seed investments, moves to demonstration, and then eventually thinks through what a program at maturity looks like.
So when you think about where this future is going, and we all know all the studies have show us how flat, if not there's a decline in math scores and science scores, even in English, in fundamental literacy in our own language, that has to be turned around, or that the kind of the lead we have now. I mean, I think there are no other countries on the planet that have the research institutions the United States of America has, and part of that is because of people who populate those institutes. But there could be a market decline, given that there's no funnel or farm team from our schools pushing its way up into those institutions, because we are so sorely behind Europeans, Indians, and Chinese societies in the areas of math, technology, and science.
I share President Obama's enthusiasm and optimism that we're going to get this right. I think the Race to the Top program the president championed and has been underway through the Department of Education under Secretary Duncan's leadership really demonstrates what we have to do. What we really need to do is improve the quality, the standards, the rigor of our nation's schools, and to do so through incentives. We're going to put $4 billion into the states who agree to basically elevate their performance, their quality of education, so that they can achieve the broad objectives that the president's called for, namely the higher education attainment rate, but also paying specific attention to science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. In fact, ironically, the only way a state competing for the Race to the Top funds can differentiate itself against its peers is to demonstrate how well it will adopt a STEM program. So the president's really said something in this initiative by saying, we're going to put resources as an incentive to get states to move up the quality ladder. We're going to give extra points for those who focus on science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. And to reinforce that point, last week before the holidays, the president, surrounded by a number of CEOs like Craig Barrett, retired out of Intel, and a number of others, came together to announce this incredible partnership with the private sector and the public sector to promote STEM education. He announced over $260 million in privately financed commitments across five initiatives to to spur a greater emphasis of science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. And I got to tell you, every CEO I interface, whether they be in the technology industry or outside of it, all point to this as the number one priority. Get the workforce in the 21st century right, and we will retain our leadership position in the world in terms of innovation. And I'm highly confident that the various tools that we're putting forward will help us achieve that objective.
So what role do you think that the big research institutions play? You came from Hopkins, and here in Maryland, in Baltimore, the University of Maryland has created this system where they are trying to funnel things into community needs, not just into hardcore research, so that they work with community colleges and partner with them to create like a feeder system from high schools to community colleges to four-year colleges. There's a role that a lot of institutions like that are reluctant to play, but that becomes a critical strategy in terms of how we view the future and what large institutions and the role they play.
Some might argue, and I might humbly suggest, that the United States higher education system is probably its single biggest asset. I mean, there are many assets that we have as a nation, but our higher education system is second to none. If you had a product and you were competing on product quality, comparing the United States higher education system against any other nation system in the world, I don't think we would have a close second. And I don't mean that to be disrespectful to other nations. I just think that our system is so phenomenal. Research institutions like Johns Hopkins and others are at the very top of that very important and impressive higher education regime. So when you're at the best of the best, you have this particular capability that is the ideas born out of the faculty at Johns Hopkins. Right now, say the $1 billion of R&D that come into Hopkins. I don't remember the exact figure because I haven't been as close to it this year, but north of $1 billion in federal R&D into Johns Hopkins. The amount of brain power thinking of new products, new services, new ideas that could lead to breakthrough industries, if we could commercialize the brain power of the Hopkins faculty 10% more than where we are today, just think of what that means from a nation's GDP. How much more economic growth will we deliver if we could squeeze just a little bit more output of translating the beautiful research done at a place like Hopkins into the jobs of the future? There are some great leaders at Hopkins. My good friend Aris, who's helping on economic development issues there, are helping to focus on this issue. But between Hopkins, Maryland, and the other research institutions across the state, there's a theory of, you know, spend a dollar more in the basic R&D, so go from $1 billion to $1.1 billion and see what you get. And then there's another view that says, how do I take the existing billion and squeeze just a little bit more commercial value out of it? By integrating with the local community, could you imagine if a local entrepreneur in the Baltimore area had easier access to the faculty, and I'm sure they already do, but they could sit there and pick their brain and say, gosh, I'd love to start a new company born out of ideas that are in your head. If we could just enable, 10 more of those conversations over the next 6 months, how many more jobs will we create in Maryland's economy by simply taking that action without any new funding? I think the potential is limitless. It's exciting.
And as we kind of wind down here, one of the issues we talked a bit about in the beginning was the question of security. And, we've seen over the last year things like cyber thieves stealing millions of dollars from banks and key secrets from our government. They got into the system. They gave them plans for a new Air Force jet and all this information that they were able to glean. And our intelligence agencies all have kind of ability to launch cyber attacks on adversaries, but they're also warning us that an adversary could do some real critical damage to the United States, and that as we move from analog to a digital world, this question of security becomes very real.
Well, it is so real that the president called for an unprecedented 60-day review of all of our strategies with respect to cybersecurity. In May, he announced the framework for how we would, as an administration, approach this issue. He's called for unprecedented collaboration across the agencies, and has called for a cybersecurity coordinator to sit in the White House who will work closely with me and our Chief Information Officer, Vivek Kundra. I am particularly focused on the collaboration we intend to offer the private sector. I have been working very closely with the financial services industry, the healthcare sector, and early stages with the energy sector to understand what we can do to better collaborate in a public-private context for strengthening up the nation's critical infrastructure. My colleague, the CIO, Vivek Kundra, is focused on hardening up the government's infrastructure itself. And the cybersecurity coordinator, who has not yet been named, but we hope to see named in the near future, will focus on ensuring we have the right policy framework across all of these dimensions moving forward. The president has made this an absolute top priority. We have teams on the ground working this issue while we await the name of the new coordinator. There are staff in place to we have weekly meetings on this issue within the White House to organize and make sure we're doing as much as we can to coordinate and collaborate. We have literally billions of dollars in investment here through the various cybersecurity initiatives, some classified, others not, and very, very important terrain. And while this is very much a serious issue, I want to give your listeners some context for hope that we will bring the engine of our university systems. In fact, Johns Hopkins and Maryland both happen to be centers of excellence for research centers dedicated to cybersecurity. We, in fact, had one testify at one of my Health IT Standards Committee hearings just not too long ago. So we'll bring our university talents, the private sector, our federal agencies around the table to help get the near-term strategies right, as well as the long-term research endeavors that will get us to a safer place as we increasingly rely upon the digital environment for our daily lives.
And are you part of wrestling with how much this is going to end up costing America to kind of do what we have to do in terms of whether it's the broadband across the nation or new information highway being built? I mean, these things cost a huge amount of money, and how that's even going to begin to take place?
Well, it's a great question, and I think in large part a great deal of that has already been absorbed into the way our systems operate today. So, you know, post 9/11, how many private companies beefed up their physical security and incorporated the costs of that into their operating expenditures? I envision the cybersecurity costs in many ways equally borne throughout the system. There are certain areas where the federal government will step up investments. I'm focused on the research and development question, where I believe we've had growth in investment. But there are other investments that will need to be made. Our network carriers are constantly improving upon their capacity and looking to find ways to monetize those services. There are today, you could buy managed services from the telecommunications sector that have better cybersecurity protections. So my sense is that we will see investments in this area grow, and that the payments of those investments will be diffused throughout our economy in various pieces and parts. And that's actually one of the policy debates that Congress is grappling with. Our new cyber coordinator will help to think through how much should be borne in the public sector, how much in the private sector. That's a healthy debate to have.
So how would you consider your time at the White House as our chief technology officer advising the President of the United States a success? I mean, how would you walk away from this job smiling?
Oh, well, that's very simple. My measure of success is ensuring that the president has received the best possible advice on the initiatives that he believes will move this nation forward. And if I've achieved an outcome of delivering on the president's expectations, that is the ultimate judge from my standpoint. There are several initiatives that I've been focused on here. We talked about healthcare IT. We've spoken about the private sector role in cybersecurity. We have not spoken as much about, but is a big part of my domain, a great deal of the work we will continue to do in broadband. There will be a national broadband plan that will come out in February from the Federal Communications Commission. I intend to work very closely with my colleagues across the administration to help implement that strategy as it is rolled out in the months following. So there are a handful of discrete initiatives that I am shepherding through on behalf of the president that have very explicit outcomes, objectives, and milestones. And so each of them have to stand on their own merits, and I will smile if they achieve their goals better, faster, and cheaper than we had anticipated when I came in.
Anish Chopra, thanks for taking so much time with us today. It's been a pleasure to talk to you.
My pleasure, and bye-bye. Mm-hmm.